Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Sunday, December 17th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Michael Portantier and Jan Simpson. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at filesaboutphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Jan Simpson. Jan is the director of the Arts and Culture Journalism Program at CUNY's Graduate School of Journalism, also writes for TDF Stages, American Theater, and has her own blog at Broadway and Me. Jan is also the host of Stagecraft, a Broadway radio podcast. And Jan, has your first episode of Theater Talk gone out yet?
Yes, it did. It did. We talked to Ayad Akhtar about Junk, and we talked to some of the women involved in the play 20th Century Blues that is on at the West Side Theater.
So Theater Talk can be found at many PBS stations around the country, and we'll put a link in the show notes to Theater Talk as well. Jan, of course, you're taking on the role of the snarky Michael Riedel role, right?
Oh, yes. Those shoes are too big to fill. Much too big to fill.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Haley Mills is joining us by telephone. Fans around the world will know this Academy Award winner, a Golden Globe winner, a BAFTA Award winner, and a Theatre World Award winner for Noel Coward's Suite in Two Keys. So, Haley, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, that is my pleasure, Michael.
So we have coming up soon, I guess it starts in January, you have a new production over at City Center. So why don't you tell us about Party Face?
Party Face is a very, very special play. It is written by a really, really clever, talented writer, actress, a woman called Isabel Machen. It is an Irish play, as you would probably guess by her name. And it's the director is Amanda Bierce, who you will know from Married with Children, and many, many other things as well. And the cast is five women, which I'm really, really looking forward to, actually, to have such a very female centered production. It's a comedy, it's Irish, it's set in a place called Carrick Mines, just outside Dublin. There are at least two genuine Irish girls in the production, Gina Costigan and Brenda Meaney, both Irish girls, and both with, both from theatrical families. I'm really looking forward to it. It's a very, very good play. It's very well written. And it's got lots of depth to it, you know. It's the best comedy is usually comedy that's based on real life stuff, you know, the deep stuff. And that's what this play does, you know. It reveals their lives eventually over the course of the play. Who these
Could you tell us a little
really
bit
are.
About your character?
I play Carmel, the mother of two of the girls. And I've come to my younger daughter's house to organize a party for her. And, I've brought all the food, and I want everything to be perfect and to look perfect. And it is a struggle to hang on to this image of perfection, this facade that everything is absolutely all right, when actually it's, you know, they're all standing on a lake with the ice cracking underneath them, and Carmel, my character is the last person to accept that this is happening. It doesn't sound very funny, but it is.
I know that the play has been very successful in Ireland already, apparently under a different title, Boom, question
yes.
mark. Can you talk about, are you aware of the reason for the title change?
I believe Boom really related to the financial boom in Ireland. And this was some years ago. Was this about 15 years ago, 20 years ago? And, there was suddenly a tremendous economic upswing. And so I think the characters, particularly my character, and yes, I think both my daughters actually benefited from this boom in the economy. And although they have all the trappings of success, affluence, the reality of their lives underneath doesn't match up to the, outer appearances. So that boom it wouldn't be really relevant to an American or, specifically to a New York audience.
And yet the subject matter sounds like a lot of Americans and New Yorkers will be able
to. Yes, of course, but not the title. I mean, it is specific to the... exactly. So our producers, Robert Dramer and Morgan Sills and Amanda Beers all decided that, it should be changed. And Isabel Mann came up with Party Face, which I think is very apposite, very good.
So, Haley, you have had an extraordinarily... large body of work that spans 60 years in film, television, and theater during this monumental time when entertainment is changing so much. What are the big changes that you have seen in your experience?
Definitely the business, the film business has become a lot more corporate. Everybody recognizes that. My experience was, I was so fortunate that my early years were spent working for Walt Disney and for him personally and in his studios, which were small and friendly and everybody knew everybody. Everyone knew everybody's first name, and Walt used to wander around the lot and greet everybody, and he knew everybody's first name. Everything has just got so much bigger now, and there is such an incredible amount of that awful word everyone uses, product. and I think that, I'm afraid that some of the... product has become just that, and it I don't know, the personal element isn't always there, and sometimes too many people are involved in the creation of a film or a television, which is art, let's face it. And I think you can have too many cooks all stirring madly the one pot, and I believe that it should be the vision of the writer, the director, the producers, the team that creates something, and the theatre still has that, and everyone involved in a production. It's lovely. Off Broadway, we have a smaller team, And you get to know everybody, and everybody is focused on the main thing. You're not having to deal with remote, anonymous executives on the phone who've made sort of collective decisions. It's a creative endeavor that involves, you know, just a handful of people, and that's really, that's lovely. That's what you know, what we all love, really.
When you went out to film Pollyanna, out at Disney, did you uproot your life? Did your parents come with you? Did you go by yourself? Did you have a guardian? How did that work for you?
My parents came with me when I was doing Pollyanna. My mother stayed with me. My father was—he came for a little bit, but he went off because he, you know, as an actor, he was constantly working.
Yeah.
So, you know, my poor mom, she had to. She was torn between me and my dad, and of course my sister Juliet. When I was doing Pollyanna, my sister Juliet was. She was working in the theater in New York. So, you know, she was only 18 at the time. And so, you know, my mom had to dash around all over the place, and it wasn't quite so quick and easy then as it is now. But luckily, she was a writer, so she was able to carry on writing. She had been an actress, but when she fell in love with my dad, and it was in the war, and that's the Second World War, in case anyone's wondering. she decided, you know, life was much too precarious, and she gave up acting to stay with my father, and that was that. You know, she was a writer from then on, and quite a successful writer. I made a couple of films based on her stories. So that's how that worked. And of course, I didn't stay there. I didn't move to California,
okay.
Even though I had, after I did Pollyanna, I signed a contract with Walt Disney, for 5 years. So altogether I made 6 movies for him. But I always went back home. That was one of the prerequisites of the contract.
California in the 60s. It's a very...
Yeah.
Could be a shock to anybody who visited, especially the Los Angeles area in the 60s.
Yeah, oh, it was wonderful. It was just absolutely wonderful. And the contrast between London in the 60s, you know, early 60s, and Los Angeles in the area. You know, London was still dealing with the aftermath of the war. You know, there wasn't much color in the world. Everything was gray and black and brown, and you know, and the effect of rationing was actually still felt, and everyone was very, very careful about not wasting food and turning the lights off and don't let the water run when you're doing your teeth. And all those kind of things went out the window in Los Angeles. I couldn't believe it. Television in every room, and the lights were all burning, and the food, the vastness of the food. We used to order one steak between the three of us, that's my mom and my brother and myself, because they were so enormous and covered the whole plate, and we divided me three. That's why I think, you know, we're all rather stunted. As a family, I hasten to add, not as a nation. So it was a very, very, very exciting experience.
You mentioned your sister Juliet was in New York doing shows. Was there any sibling rivalry between the two of you?
No, there wasn't, actually. The thing is that Juliet had actually started acting. She started, the first thing she ever did, she was 3 months old, I think. She was the baby in the basket in a film that my father did called In Which We Serve, which was directed by Noel Coward. And then she did a couple of films with my father when she was 5, and then another one when she was 7. And then she didn't do anything after that and grew up normally. Then she did Alice Through the Looking Glass when she was 15 in London in the theatre. And then when she was 17, instead of going to drama school, as she and everyone had planned, she did an audition and got the part in Peter Shaffer's play, Five Finger Exercise. So she never went to drama school. She did Five Finger Exercise, and she was in London with the play for a year, and then the play went, I should say, came to New York, and she was here for a year. So the need for drama school kind of dwindled, because, you know, there's nothing like practical experience to learn your craft. And 2 years in that play with Jessica Tandy and Roland Culver when it was in New York. And she was making her name in the theatre. I had done a movie when I was 12, and she was already doing Five Finger Exercise in London. And I did this movie called Tiger Bay with my dad, and it was a good movie. And it got, you know, it got good reviews, and nice things were said about everybody. And then I went back to school and forgot about it. And it all happened sort of slowly. And then I met Disney. And then I did Pollyanna the following year. And Juliet has always been hugely supportive and encouraging and just wonderful, wonderful about my whatever I was doing. And she went to see that first movie I did called Tiger Bay about 6 times. And I think she had to see what it was I was doing and decided it was all right, and she was proud of me. And I've always felt ever since that she was proud of me.
The two of
As
you,
I am very proud of her. Yes.
The two of you did Legends, the James Kirkwood play.
Yes.
I read that you toured with it. I'm interested in that experience, and if you've worked together at other times, what the experience has been.
Well, Legends was frankly a bit of a debacle, because although it was
it always is.
It wasn't really very funny. But the other play we've done together was a play called Fallen Angels by Noel Coward. And that was funny. That was very, very funny. And we did that in England, and then we took it on tour, and we did it in the Antipodes. And we were with that play for 14 months. And we had such a good time. It was wonderful. She's a very, very good comedian, and one of the people who makes me laugh most in my life, apart from my father, who was extremely funny also. So yes, it was a really good experience. I don't know. You know, I think there's a time and a place for plays, and I don't. You know, it wasn't the right moment for us and Legends, quite honestly. But we had a great time doing it in Australia because we love working together.
You have such extensive stage credits. I know that you did the 90s production of The King and I all over the U.S. I am so sorry I missed it. I almost caught you in Boston, and then it didn't work.
All right.
Then let's see, An Evening of Alan Bennett at the New York Public Library in 2002. I assume that was a one-nighter.
Yes.
And then Vagina Monologues at the West Side Theater in 2000, and Suite in Two Keys at the Lortel also in 2000. But we don't get you on stage in New York very often, so we're just so happy to have you back.
I'm very happy to be back. I have been, I used to live here about, 5 years ago. My partner is, he's a New Yorker. But I always had a place in London. And then I've also got grandchildren. When my grandchildren started to arrive, I realized it was time for me to go home. And so I'm very, very, very thrilled to be back here. And I love this city. And I arrived a couple of days ago, and it was snowing, and it was just perfect. I know you probably New Yorkers, you go, oh, my God, no, not snow. But I loved it. It was perfect. New York in the snow is just, it's such a wonderful contrast, isn't it? This great, big, dirty city suddenly covered in snow like a bride. I absolutely love it. And went up to the park and walked around, and I'm thrilled to be back here. And thrilled to be doing this wonderful play, which I haven't even started rehearsals yet. We start tomorrow, so I'm getting very kind of like, you know, geared up, eating my oats and drinking my Guinness. And I'm kidding, but it's great. It's fun, and there's some very, very, very talented people involved, and I know we're going to have a wonderful time.
Well, Haley, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning to talk with us on Broadway Radio about Party Face, which begins performances on January 11th, 2018, which is just around the corner. You start rehearsals tomorrow. It's going to be up at City Center on 131 West 55th Street, and so we'll have a link to everything in the show notes. Haley, thank you so much again, and we'll be speaking with you soon. Have a wonderful day.
All right. All right. Well, thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you and all of you.
Okay, so the three of us got a chance to see Steve Martin's new play, Meteor Shower, with Amy Schumer, Keegan-Michael Key, Laura Benanti, and Jeremy Shamos. And let me start off with this one by saying that I have this as my big go-to must-get tickets referral for everybody because I thought it was hysterical. It was so strange, and I think that we'll get to the strangeness in a bit. I was really, really stunned about how much I enjoyed this, that the individual performances were just – I can't think of how this – just a four-person play. I don't think that they could have cast any of these roles with anybody better. It seems as though that to me it was just – absolutely perfect and a bit over the top. And I have some friends who are theater aficionados who kind of were mensa mensa on it, but you know, this is a limited run and I'm telling everybody to get tickets to it. The story is about two couples that get together and with the excuse of there's a meteor shower happening and one of the couples came from another part of town to see this better. And it seems as though that this couple has had a reputation. This is the Keegan-Michael Key and Laura Benanti couple that has had a reputation of causing havoc. And so, and it plays off in three, maybe four different scenarios where you see it restart from the beginning and have different outcomes. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a great evening. It's only 80 minutes, no intermission. It was very, very funny. So, Jan, what did you think about this?
I wasn't as high on it as you are. It is fun. There's no doubt about that. I laughed. My husband, who's pretty hard to please in terms of theater, he laughed and enjoyed it. But I wasn't really sure what Steve Martin was after here, and I wondered if the couple that Keegan-Michael Key and Laura Benanti play were supposed to be like maybe the id of the mm-hmm. characters that Amy Schumer and Jeremy Shamos play, and so this was actually all happening in their heads. And I also wondered if I'm a big Jerry Zaks fan, but I wondered if another director might have just helped some of us in the audience see a little more clearly what Steve Martin was trying to say with this show. But as you said, it's 80 minutes. It's great fun. I thought they were all quite good. I was particularly impressed by Amy Schumer, who I'd never seen on stage, and she seemed to me quite comfortable. I read some things where people thought she was a little bit stiff, a little mugging. I didn't find that. I thought she was really comfortable. And of course, I mean, Laura Benanti is just, you know, a treasure. So whenever I got a little bit off, she would bounce on and say something and I'd be right back in it. So I had fun.
Michael, what about you?
Well, I certainly agree that there were a lot of laughs, although I have to say the night I went, the theater was extremely cold.
Oh.
And it was, I think, that first really bitterly cold night of the week. And what was annoying was that when the show first started, I felt fine. And then about 20 minutes in or a half hour in, I noticed it seemed like air conditioning coming down on me. And I had to really basically put my coat on. And I noticed some people around me doing the same if they could. And I know there's a theory that comedy works better when with a cooler temperature, but I think there's a limit to that. And I was not very happy with that. I think if you're uncomfortable, you laugh less. So I didn't enjoy it as much as I would have if I hadn't been so cold. Note to the house staff. By the time, as I say, it happened about 20 minutes in, so it was – I guess I could have gotten up from my seat and walked to the back and tried to find someone to complain, but I thought that would have been more disruptive than anything. So I hope if those of you who attend don't have that experience. I was equally impressed with Amy Schumer. I know very little of her work, but she seemed completely comfortable. Mm-hmm. On stage, I didn't think she was stiff at all. I thought her timing was expert, and she does have a lot of maybe not lately, but I believe she has a lot of stand-up experience, and that showed with her. Jeremy Shamos, who plays her husband, Norm, is, of course, a honored stage veteran. He's done so many shows over the past several years, often in somewhat similar roles. He's great at playing sort of somewhat nerdy, befuddled guys, mm-hmm. but with a tremendous comic instinct. And I was glad to see him in it. I remembered, and I looked it up, that he was a replacement in this role. Yeah, it was supposed to have been Alan Tudyk. And that happened early on. I'm not sure if they had even begun rehearsals or certainly Alan Tudyk didn't do any performances, but I wonder what happened with that. And Laura Benanti.
I think they said creative differences.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds familiar. So at least that's honest, you know, not scheduling difficulties.
I don't know what you mean.
Laura Benanti, we know primarily as a musical theater actress, but she has demonstrated her ability to be hilarious on stage many times before, and so that stood her in good stead. The only one who seemed not quite at the same level to me was Keegan-Michael Key. I thought he was certainly very amusing, and he got all of his laughs as well, but I can't quite explain this. It seemed to me that he was acting it more as a stand-up comedian than as a character actor. And so I don't know if that's just something I was completely reading into it.
I agree. He was a little off, a little too big.
Yes, and seemed to be commenting on the character more than living it. And make no mistake, lots of very odd things happen in this play. It's not realistic in any way. And Jan said something earlier, which at the very end, you do get a tip off as to maybe explain why incredibly strange things are occurring at every moment. And so in retrospect, I think this play makes more sense than while it's happening. While it is happening, I think it's meant to keep you off guard constantly. And so the reason for that becomes, I guess, clear in the last few moments of the play. In case you're wondering while it's happening, what the hell is going on? hold on till the end, and then whether the explanation is too pat or not, that's up to you. But there is a sort of reason for everything. I think that the audience is probably getting exactly what they came for, and it's not my ideal type of comedy. But I don't think that. I really doubt that anyone who's coming to see a very funny play by Steve Martin with Amy Schumer and lots of other great people in it, I don't think any of those people are going to be disappointed.
No, I totally agree with you there. So, I Meteor Shower is playing a limited run. They are playing through January 21st. So you only have about a month or so to go see it. I think that if they played through the award season, I think that they would get lots of awards. I don't know if they're going to be able to be recognized during award season without the show running.
Yeah. Lots of nominations anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. So I could see Amy Schumer and all of them, in fact, getting some sort of nomination. I don't know what category each one of them would fit into, if it would be leading or supporting in a play. But certainly Steve Martin, I think, would get a Best Play nomination. We'll have to see. And Jerry Zaks, possibly a Best Direction. But it really is over the top, and I can't say enough about it. But I don't think that many folks are going to get to see it because of this short thing, and I think that's due to a lot of scheduling. I don't think that that's creative differences.
No, these are really
scheduling.
Busy people. Yeah, really busy people.
All right. So next up, Jan, why don't you tell us about the new Broadway show, The Children?
The Children is an import from Britain. It's a play written, I believe I should have this right here. I believe the author is Lucy Kirkwood, a young British playwright. And it's particularly, well, I'll get to that in a sec. It's a three-person play starring Francesca Annis, Ron Cook, and Deborah Finley. It's directed by James McDonald. It's about a couple. They are retired nuclear physicists, and they live in a remote part of England, near a power plant where they once worked. And there has been a breach at the power plant. It has affected the neighborhood in the sense of natural disaster. This is obviously not a natural disaster, but the way natural disasters have affected communities, food is limited, electricity is down, but they are fine. They are making it in their little cottage where they live. But as the play opens, they are visited by an old friend, someone they worked with at the power plant, who has just sort of mysteriously appeared. They haven't seen her in something like 30, 35 years. And she just appears at their a doorstep. And we know that there must be a reason for her visit. As the play begins to unfold, we think we know the reason for the visit, but there's a switch sort of in the middle of the play, and it's not what we think. She's come to ask them something very different. And I'm being purposely vague because I think that's part of the journey of the play that you want to take. However, I will say that this play fits into a number of plays that I've seen over the past decade, I would say, that are written by playwrights in their 30s and early 40s, maybe late 20s to early 40s, and so are the children of the baby boom generation. And these playwrights are, I don't know how else to say it, they are really pissed off at us baby boomers. They are just really angry, and they really want to bring us to account. And so the power plant is the driving force in this play, but it's also a metaphor, I think, for how the older generation has messed up the world and left this mess to our collective children to deal with. And this play is wrestling or attempting to wrestle with responsibility and obligation for this mess, be it the concrete power plant that these three people have built or helped to build and helped to operate before their retirements, or the larger society, be it, you know, what's going on in England right now with Brexit, or what's going on here with the Trump administration. It's, I think, a very well acted, performed play, all three actors at the top of their game. But it made me, I would love to sit down with one of those playwrights and really talk about this intergenerational. It's a quiet sort of war going on, but this intergenerational war from their point of view.
So do you ever have an opportunity to sit down with playwrights and talk about their plays?
Yes, I do. Yes,
okay.
I do.
Is this foreshadowing? Okay.
But I haven't had a chance yet to talk to Lucy Kirkwood. I don't know if she's here. I don't know if she's available. But it's a thought-provoking play, a very serious piece of work. But also, as with I think all good dramas, there's some levity, there's some comedy involved as well to balance it out. So it's not a grim experience by any means.
All right. So we will stay tuned to your other show, Jan, to make sure that we catch anything that you might have further with the children. Michael, you got a chance to see Farinelli and the King with Mark Rylance. So tell us about Farinelli.
This is the Shakespeare's Globe production of Farinelli and the King, which is a new play by Claire Van Campen. And it represents her playwriting debut and a very, very successful one, I would say. Claire Van Campen is primarily known as a composer, and she is also the spouse of Mark Rylance, who plays King Philippe V of Spain in the play. But any fears you might have about nepotism or whatever that's called when it's the spouse involved, because Mark Rylance is quite a very, very well-respected, one might almost say towering figure in the theater, has been for quite some years, including a directorship, artistic directorship of Shakespeare's Globe for quite a few years. And he has been hailed in his Broadway appearances and awarded. And so I guess he's the muscle of the couple in that sense. But the quality of this play, I would say, is excellent and is not I would like to think it would have been produced even if it wasn't for that connection. It is about the relationship between Philippe and the castrato Farinelli, and the action is set in the first part of the 18th century, the early to mid 1700s. In case some of our listeners don't know what a castrato was, this is a, many would say, a barbaric practice that used to take place where pre-adolescent boys who had beautiful singing voices would be castrated, so that their voices would not change, and they would continue to sing in that very high soprano-y register even as they passed through adolescence. But the theory was that they would do this with the physiognomy of a male rather than a woman. And the sound that therefore that was created was very different from a soprano or from a from an adult male singing in falsetto. Anyway, this used to be done in Italy and perhaps elsewhere, but it eventually was outlawed for obvious reasons. And we can't know what that sounded like unless, I suppose, someone nowadays. I wonder if that has happened at all in recent decades, where someone needed to be castrated for medical reasons and then wound up being a singer. I don't know of any incident of that, but I'll have to look into it. The King was apparently what we would now classify or diagnose as bipolar. He had lots of mental issues and very strange behavior because of it. And what is presented in this play, which apparently is a great deal of it is historically accurate, is that Philippe's wife, Isabella, brings Farinelli to the Spanish court because he is so famous, and it's a kind of a coup to bring him there. But it turns out that his beautiful singing has a very, very healthful effect on the king's state of mind, to the point where he really begins to cast off almost all, if not all, of his odd behavior and behave like a normal person. And there's much discussion of that kind of effect that's having here, a music therapy, we would call it nowadays. And so this very, very close relationship develops between Philippe and Farinelli and also Isabella. Farinelli is acted by Sam Crane, but the several pieces of music in the play are sung by Yeston Davis is the main person who sings the role of Farinelli. And then apparently his alternate is James Hall, whom I believe does matinees on two show days. I am told that you can check the website for the show, and if you want to see a particular person, or just so you'll know who is singing. Also, as you go into the theater, there is the board in the lobby, which will tell you who is singing the role of Farinelli. And I did not hear James Hall, but all I can say is Yeston Davis. He did such a beautiful job that he almost changed my mind about countertenors, because that's what that would be called nowadays, a countertenor. It's an adult male, who has not been castrated, but who sings in that, falsetto register. Many countertenors that I have heard over the years have always sounded too screechy to me, and I never really saw the point of it. I've never previously known a countertenor who sounded more beautiful to me than a soprano would, singing the same music. But here, there was none of that screechiness, just beautiful, beautiful, lovely sound. And it really made you feel that you could understand how this would actually calm someone's mental state and clear up his mind. So I think that the playwriting, even though it is Claire Van Campen's debut, is very, very skillful. The storytelling is clear. The character relationships are completely clear. Isabella, I should say, is played by Melody Grove, and the growing relationship between her and Farinelli becomes an issue as well. There's this quite interesting, one might say, triangle that comes to exist between the king and the queen and Farinelli. The physical production, as one might assume, is beautiful. This Shakespeare's Globe production in the Belasco Theater, which is the perfect theater for it, and also where not too many years ago we also saw the Shakespeare's Globe production of two Shakespeare plays, Twelfth Night and Richard III, both of them featuring or starring Mark Rylance. I think that the milieu is perfect for the play, and I just was so impressed with the writing itself. I expected, of course, to be bowled over by Mark Rylance because he's been so brilliant in everything. But the remainder of the cast and the physical production and the storytelling and the story itself is so interesting. And all the more so because it is based so closely on real life events. There's a wonderful insert that you will find in your playbill with notes by David Cody, really kind of detailing what actually happened, what didn't. It tells you what was the castrato sound, who was Farinelli, does music therapy actually work, was Philippe V really this unhinged, and how much court intrigue swirled around him. So you can, this is one of those cases where you can do research before or after, if you choose, into the actual lives of Farinelli and Philippe and Isabella. Either way, I think that you will find this play extremely enjoyable. And the live music sung live and played live on stage really adds to it. It's as if you're getting two entertainments for the price of one. Here's an interesting note. I think many of the arias will be unfamiliar to lots of listeners, but there is one that that many may know. It's a song called Lascia ch'io pianga, and it is included on Barbra Streisand's classical Barbra album. So I was kind of looking around when that aria started to see if I noticed signs of recognition on the faces of people in the audience, because I think that's going to happen for that aria more than anything else. I highly recommend this play, and I'm so glad that I got to see it.
the privilege to see Mark Rylance.
It sounds sort of like the Madness of King George the Third meets the King's Speech.
That is an excellent description.
Oh, thank you. I haven't seen it yet. is it one or two acts?
It's two acts, but it's not very long. And they do create the impression, as they did with the two Shakespeare plays, that it's candlelit. There are, I guess, what do you call it? Like hanging chandeliers that are candles. I guess it wouldn't be candelabra, but there are those. There are some of those. And the lighting, the actual lighting that is used in addition to that is quite dim. I will say this might be a case where if you were seated way far back in the theater, that might be something of an issue in terms of facial expressions, but I wasn't seated there, so I can't really tell you. If there is any amplification, it's very, very, very minor, and just a whole feeling of naturalness and a theater of another time that's actually absolutely perfect for this kind of story. The costumes are gorgeous. Everything is just beautiful.
So Farinelli and the King is over at the Belasco. It is playing through March 25th. So again, not playing through the award season. And right when Rylance was cast in this, or the announcement was made that Rylance was going to be doing it, Matt Tamanini and I spoke about it on Today on Broadway. And Matt immediately said, "I just can't wait for Rylance's speech." So on the Tony Awards. So so we'll have to see about that. All right. Jan, you got over to Classic Stage Company to see the Fiasco Theater's 12th Night. So I was a bit confused about this. Is this a rental or is this a Classic Stage production?
It's listed as a Classic Stage production of the Fiasco Theater Company's 12th Night. So I don't know what the relationship is between the two. But it is not a rental. It is part of the CSE stage. I'm just going to get right to it and say I was disappointed. I was really excited about seeing this. Because, first off, 12th Night, it is, I think, the first Shakespeare I ever saw. And it remains my favorite comedy, and probably because it was the first Shakespeare I saw. So I already had a love for the play. And the Fiasco Theater Company, a few years ago, maybe just a couple of years ago, did a production of Into the Woods. And I went to see that and was so totally charmed by the way they did it, which was very small, very minimal, but very inventive. Actors creating props themselves. A lot of the sort of imaginative storytelling on stage. I mean, real... I'm never sure of what the exact term is for that when they are producing a play in such a way that the emphasis is on the storytelling itself. So I was looking forward to this production, and it seemed very non-Fiasco, actually, to me. It was a pretty straightforward production of 12th Night, but the part of the Fiasco aesthetic that they brought to it was that they didn't do it in period dress. They were wearing sweaters and the sort of indescribable time period clothes, where it could be hipsters in Brooklyn today or people from the 1930s. You're not really quite sure. And so it just sort of fell in the middle. It wasn't, it didn't have their exuberance that they usually have, and it didn't have the traditional over-the-topness that sometimes Twelfth Night can have, particularly with the characters of Malvolio and Sir Toby Belch and Andrew Agacek and Festin the Clown. These are highly comedic roles, and there weren't a lot of laughs, and it was a very uneven a cast. Some of them were quite accomplished, and some of them almost appeared to be interns. There was one guy who seemed just so delighted that he was getting through his lines that he kept looking at the audience and smiling like, got it, right? It was a real hodgepodge of a performance, and I was really disappointed.
All right. So,
I know. I know. What can I say? I would love someone else to see it on the show, and I would love to hear what you guys thought of it. I think it's been getting sort of middling responses from other critics as well, but I'd be particularly interested in what you guys thought.
All right, so we'll see next week when Peter returns if he has seen it. Michael, do you have this on your schedule?
No, I wasn't able to schedule it. It does sound to me different than the other Fiasco shows that I have seen. So yeah. That's a very interesting remark there, Jan. I'm going to have to see if I can check it out.
Okay, so that is Down to Classic Stage Company through January 6th. The reason that I asked if it was a rental or a Classic Stage, because it didn't seem like John Doyle had any input into this production, according to their website. And that's why I thought it was just so strange that, you know, John Doyle took over the role of which artistic director at Classic Stage Company last year or so. And it's strange to bring in such a major production and him not to have input into it.
Well, maybe he liked it because the actors play their own instruments.
Oh.
And they sing.
Good point.
I don't know. Maybe he had an affinity for it for that reason.
But also, I think Fiasco, I mean, they have their own artistic staff, and I think they kind of do it themselves. I'm not surprised that he would not be the director of Twelfth Night.
No, maybe not the director, but at least, you know, oversee the production in some way. But it's strange for Classic Stage Company, whose mission is to do, you know, classic plays, to outsource that, you know, in some way. So.
Yeah, but we are seeing a lot of the institutional theaters, if that's the word for them, and the nonprofits. It seems to me we're seeing even more of them importing or bringing in productions intact that have been elsewhere. I mean, that's mm-hmm. true.
Roundabout did that with the Into the Woods, you know.
Roundabout has several this season, and isn't the children
right from the National? Yep. Yeah, and the next thing they're doing at CSC is Fire and Air, the Terrence McNally play about the Ballet Russe.
Oh, yes.
And that is directed by John Doyle, but it's not a classic. It's a new play. So I think they're, under his direction, perhaps his artistic direction, changing their focus a little bit.
Before we wrap up today, I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in Apple Podcasts. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, Android device, and get us streamed directly to you. iHeartRadio plays us. Google Play has us. TuneIn plays us. Anywhere that you can listen to find a podcast, you can find Broadway Radio. And contact information for Jan, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Now, normally we'd have a trivia answer and question here, but I couldn't get my schedule together with Peter this week in order to pre-record that. So all of you who skipped to the end just to do trivia, we got you this week. So next week we'll have an answer to last week's trivia and a new question as well. So on behalf of Jan Simpson and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.